Back at it with you. Very busy show on Thursday, October 22nd, right here on Connecticut Today. We chatted with an author in the 3 o'clock hour about a brand new book outlining the role that James Baker played in various Republican positions during both the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. Dr. Gary Rose joined us in the 3 o'clock hour as well to preview an upcoming presidential debate, the final debate before the election. And in the 4 o'clock hour, we gave you portions of Governor Ned Lamont's latest address regarding COVID-19. Get into the back layers of presidential history. You know, we know all these presidents, but we also hear about certain people associated with them that always become parts of the narrative. And we're going to talk about James Baker III. Now, you remember James Baker? He was the White House Chief of Staff, and he served as Treasury Secretary under President Reagan, and then as Secretary of State and Chief of Staff under President George H.W. Number 41 Bush. New book out, Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. Charles Denyer is the author, and the book will be released officially on December 15th. But you can, of course, go to Amazon, pre-order that and all that. Hey, Charles, Paul here on WICC. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. You know, Charles, I love this sort of stuff because I think, Charles, just about probably from now with President Trump all the way back to George Washington, there are those kind of secondary and tertiary people around any president, Charles, good or bad, that people kind of associate with leaders and say, oh, yeah, I remember him. They were kind of like really tight in the White House and before. Is that part of the reason you undertook this book to kind of illustrate what was going on, the synergy between, you know, Mr. Baker, Mr. Bush, and Ronald Reagan, for that matter?
Oh, absolutely. I think both Presidents Reagan and President Bush were highly successful for a number of reasons, but one fundamentally important reason was a man named James Addison Baker III. I think without Baker there, I'm not too sure how successful these two men would have been.
Now, Mr. Baker, who I guess is still with us, he's 90 years old from what I can tell, so God bless. He served as Chief of Staff and Treasury Secretary first under President Reagan. Now, people may say, nah, Treasury Secretary, okay, but Charles, as you know, as we know now from what's going on, the position of White House Chief of Staff is, from what I've read and from what I've heard from people who have been close to that, a very important and, shall we say, a pivotal slot, I think, Charles, that a lot of people don't really understand sometimes.
Well, that's true. And first of all, Baker is still with us. I was with him yesterday at Rice University in Houston. He looks like he's about 71, not
wow.
90 or 91.
Wow.
It's amazing. It's well known within the circles of Washington, D.C., that the right, and I'll preface the right, but the right White House Chief of Staff is arguably the second most powerful person in the nation behind the president. He is an immense gatekeeper of all things that come and go to the president. James Baker was, in my opinion, the greatest and the finest Chief of Staff ever to serve a president.
Why? What made Baker so good at that, Charles?
He understood the pulse of politics. He understood people. He could read people. He was a great negotiator. He was everything that you wanted in a White House Chief of Staff, organized, disciplined, also savvy, dogged, partisan, but at the same time, conciliatory. Any word that you needed to make up that perfect White House Chief of Staff, that was Baker.
So the Chief of Staff then, Charles, is really that last guy or gal, right, to say, okay, this person can sit down with the president, or I'm going to show him this. He doesn't need to see that. That's what I've been told. Is that true in your mind?
Correct, but it's much more than that. It's much more than just a physical or a virtual gatekeeper. It's also somebody who makes decisions for the president, and it's also somebody who helps formulate policy for the president. And that, to me, is much more consequential than who the president can or cannot see.
See, that's fascinating to me because, Charles, I don't think a lot of people realize the importance of what you just said, that you have a chief of staff who they may know, they see these names come and go, but I don't think people realize the policy implications that you just mentioned.
No, it's pretty immense. And I'm also the personal biographer to former Vice President Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney was obviously the youngest chief of staff ever to President Ford. An example would be President Ford would sit down with Chief of Staff Cheney, and something would come their way, and the president would ask Cheney, what should we do about it? Cheney would look at the president and go, well, we'll staff it out, basically kill it. So the Chief of Staff and the president had the ability to kill anything if they wanted to. That's how powerful they are.
How did, briefly, how did James Baker become associated with the with Ronald Reagan and come to serve in his administration?
Well, Baker tried twice to end Reagan's political career, once in 1976, which he successfully did temporarily by giving the nomination to helping win the nomination for President Ford. And then he ran, obviously, Bush's campaign in 1980, which was a failed primary. However, Reagan was so politically savvy and astute, which most people don't recognize, that he looked at he looked back at the 1980 primaries against Bush and said, that's the guy I want on my team. And Baker joined the general campaign. And after the general campaign, when they beat Carter, he said to Baker, I need somebody like you. I've seen how good you were on the other side for George Herbert Walker Bush, and I want you on my side now. Will you be my chief?
See, that to me is you know, at the same time, Charles, it's fascinating, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's almost like a, you know, a head coach or a general manager of a sports franchise. Like, God, I hated playing against that guy, but, you know, can we get our uniform on him? You know, what's it going to take? That to me is what it sounds like.
Yeah, well, Reagan had the good sense to pick the best man out there and the best man out there to run his administration was the man who tried to defeat him. But that also speaks to the good nature of Reagan. There's no animosity towards James Baker. If there was animosity, the animosity was towards George Herbert Walker Bush when he called Reagan's policies voodoo economics.
Yeah, and I can imagine, you know, James Baker obviously, you know, taking the chief of staff job and then probably sitting there, you know, kind of, did he have to be a conduit or some sort of, I don't want to say peacemaker, Charles, but was it in a, despite Mr. Reagan's forethought to bring him aboard, was it difficult for James Baker to kind of smooth things over, if even that was necessary? You know what I mean here? I mean, he was in the other camp here, and Reagan was coming in at a real difficult time.
He was in the other camp, and a lot of Reagan loyalists looked at Baker with a disdain, number one. But secondly, what he did do, he made it very well known to me. He said this again yesterday, actually, when I was just with him. I was in a very powerful position as White House Chief of Staff, and one of the first things I wanted to do was make sure my best friend, Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, had access to the president, had meetings with the president, and was in the loop, because traditionally vice presidents had not had that. Walter Mondale did, but before Mondale, that was not the case. So he, as he told me yesterday, I did whatever I could to pay back my big brother, who he calls Jefe.
That's great. And you mentioned friend, and we hear about the terms friends and friendship, and a lot of people, you know, in politics in the U.S., you know, they say that's not possible in politics. But I guess, does your book show it is? I mean, is there, you know, does friendship still, even in this day, count?
We hope it counts, and we know it existed. It existed with James Baker and George Herbert Walker Bush. Look, there's been many political partnerships over the years. Some of them are tenacious political ideologues, such as Cheney and Rumsfeld. Some are marriages, Bill and Hillary Clinton. But the true, endearing, personal political friendship on display, one of the finest ever, was between Bush and Baker. It's an amazing story of how close they came and were together for 60 years. They're best friends.
Charles Denyer is the author. Charles, hang on. We'll be right back with you. I'm going to do a few more minutes. The name of the book, Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. Charles Denyer is the guest. First, traffic and weather together. Then we'll get back to more right after this. The name of the book, Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power, comes out December 15th of this year. But, of course, you can pre-order it now at Amazon or go get it at your local bookstore. Charles Denyer is the guest. So, Charles, then to the George H.W. Bush administration. James Baker then segues after the Reagan years. He becomes Secretary of State in 1989. And during his tenure as state secretary, I remember, of course, many of our listeners do, Charles, the first Gulf War occurred and tensions rose in the Middle East.
Correct. And I don't think any other president would have ever foreseen, if they had a crystal ball, what was coming their way. It was unbelievable, the 48 months, the cataclysmic events that unfolded from January 1989 until Bush's leaving of office in January 1993. But it was a testament to how these two gentlemen worked together, and also worked together on the international front with world leaders, but probably just as important, worked together with a Democratic-controlled Congress to help steward a lot of the policy directives regarding the fall of the Berlin Wall, the reunification of Germany, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the invasion of Panama, the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq, an unbelievable set of events that transpired. But time and time again, the president turned to his most trusted advisor, James A. Baker III, for leadership in these areas.
You mentioned earlier in our chat about Mr. Baker's ability to read people, to understand maybe what they were thinking or deliberating. Was that his strength, Charles, in dealing with, say, Congress and the Democratic Party during some of the things that you just mentioned?
Yeah, Baker's, in my opinion, Baker's greatest strength is he's such an incredibly personable and genuine human being. At one point of his career, he's a campaign gunslinger. He ran or co-chaired five successive presidential campaigns from 1976 to 1992. Then he's running the White House. Then he's running Treasury issues for the wealthiest country in the world. Then he becomes the international diplomat as Secretary of State. Name any political operative in the last 50 years who has made this transition so successful from one job to the next in the political arena. And I think it's because you can attach dozens of different words that describe him. At the end of the day, he's a very personable, genuine human being, and people like to be around James A. Baker.
And I think when you tell me about Mr. Baker and other people I've interviewed, like stories like this, presidents, Charles, are either successful or not. And I believe it was David Axelrod who talked about going to Washington with President Obama. If they have the right people around them who can say, hey, that's a great idea, or the ability to look a president in the eye and say, no, don't do that. I wouldn't do that, sir. We can't do that.
That's true. And a funny story about that is when Baker and Bush would have a political disagreement and Bush felt he was right, he would look at him and go, Baker, if you're so smart, why am I president and you're not?
Well, that could do it, I guess. Personal things between them, Charles, away from politics, and maybe that's tough to divorce out of the scenario, but as men, talk about this relationship, if you can separate it from the daily grind of policy, international, and both local.
Well, one came from the East Coast, from aristocracy, and the other one was as a Texan can be. But at the end of the day, they loved their barbecue. They loved throwing horseshoes. They loved hunting. They loved fishing. They loved going out on ranches. They loved horseback riding. They had a lot of similarities. One of the things that Baker told me was, in all the times I spent with my best friend, he never once cut a corner on anything at the golf course, about not paying for a meal. He was absolutely a man of integrity. And I know Bush would say the same about Baker. They could finish each other's sentences. They're always on the same wavelength. They just understood each other very well. There was a difference. Bush was 6'2 and a half. Baker was 6'1, a little shorter than Jim, than George.
How do you think, and this may be a tough question to answer here, but how do you think, well, maybe he's talked to you about this, obviously, what are Mr. Baker's thoughts on the world scene as we see it today, Charles? What's he tell you about what maybe he would do, or maybe the way America's pointed correctly or incorrectly looking at some of our adversaries now?
Well, some of the major tenets or themes that he has spoken to me about is China should not be considered our enemy. China is a superpower that we need to work with. North Korea should not have nuclear weapons. Other countries should not have nuclear weapons. We need to be engaged in diplomatic efforts around the world as much as we can for economic reasons. We need to continue to aspire to human rights. all the high-level things that I think we can all agree on. Yeah, but Baker is the great negotiator. I firmly believe that he believes war is a last resort. He did much like anybody in this country in 1991. We did not want to go to war, but Saddam Hussein gave us no choice. Remember in 2006, he came out with the Iraq Study Group, gave a laundry list of recommendations to then-President George W. Bush on how to best handle the deteriorating issues in Iraq. So diplomacy is what he works at as best.
How do you think he would fit in perhaps, Charles, today's body politic on either side? Would he be able to pull off what he did, or generationally, would that just be tough because of, you know, frankly, how bitter and divided we are now?
I think it'd be a real challenge because it's so partisan now. And back then it wasn't as partisan, but the left has become more left, the right has become more right, and the center has become slimmer. And with that said, that doesn't leave you much wiggle room for compromise. And Baker excelled at compromising. And that's difficult in this day and age. And I think it's going to become even more difficult, you know, when we find out what happens in 12 days in terms of who we think is going to win and why.
The name of the book, Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. Pre-order it right now, folks. It comes out in hardcover December 15th of this year, so perfect for that Christmas time or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa, whatever. Charles Denyer is the author. Charles, continue. Good luck. We appreciate it, and hopefully when your next one comes out, we can chat as well. Thanks, Charles.
Wonderful time. Take care.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate it. There you go, folks. Charles Denyer, D-E-N-Y-E-R, D as in David, E-N-Y-E-R. If you're a political junkie like I am, Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush, and James Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. James Baker, serving as Chief of Staff and U.S. Treasury Secretary under Mr. Reagan, and U.S. Secretary of State and Chief of Staff under President George H.W. number 41 Bush. Apparently, we're only going to have two. This was supposed to be the third one. It's now the second one. The debate tonight between President Trump and former VP Joe Biden taking place, of course, with COVID procedures put in place. What about the debates? What about the state of the race? Has everyone stocked up on munchies for tonight? We're going to have the microphones cut off maybe, too. This one could be interesting. Joining us, one of our go-to guys, Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chair, Department of Government and Politics at Sacred Heart University. Gary, how are you?
Good, Paul. Good to be with you.
Gary, thank God the microphones are going to get cut off tonight, because that first one was just... That was, you know, Gary, that was like roller derby. Remember roller derby when we were growing up?
Yeah, I do remember roller derby. Yes, I do.
That's exactly what that was. And I was watching that, Gary, to both guys going, will you shut up? Oh,
yeah.
Boy, this is going to be interesting. I mean, what's going to happen when the president gets his mic cut off tonight?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I know. I understand that the individual who's controlling the mute button is going to be behind the screen or behind the stage, I guess. You're not going to be able to see who the person is, which makes it even more interesting. And can you imagine Donald Trump having his mic cut off? I mean, really, this could end up being a real spectacle tonight. This really could.
The thing is Gary, and I've kept saying this since we saw that, if both Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden could use this to their advantage, keep your mouth shut, let the other person answer, and then come back very calmly and say, okay, now let me tell you what the real facts are. And I think both sides could probably say, listen, jot down some notes during, you know, what you want to cover, and then you're going to have a chunk of time where the other guy can't say anything.
I know. Yeah, I guess there's one way that you could actually come out very well in a debate like this, where you can, you know, essentially box a person in. And if, in fact, you are muting your opponent's mic, then you could end up actually, in some respects, maybe having the really last word on a topic. And when they come in, you know, it's not going to be the same when you have quick and spontaneous rebuttals. And there will be rebuttal, but at the same time, I think that this could possibly work to somebody's advantage if they know how to strategically work around this mute button.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, Gary, we're at a point now where, you know, people can criticize, I think, the Biden campaign's tactic of very limited to practically really no open press events, very few public events. But you know what, the polls really, I know they're tightening a little bit, but, you know, this may work out for them. You know, the low-key campaign may in the end work.
I know. It's really quite incredible how he's leading so well in the polls. And I know they're tightening in some states, but nevertheless, you know, there's so much animosity towards President Trump among the voters that I think the larger strategy here is just to let the voters continue to see Trump and to see him at his rallies on TV, not necessarily those who attend the rallies, but just to the more public the president is, I think the Biden strategy is that, well, it's going to be an inverse relationship. You know, the more the people see him, the less they like him. And so there's no need to actually go out and campaign. Just let Trump dig his own hole. I think that might be the strategy, which is the first time I've ever seen anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, you know, Gary, we've, you know, I have a hypothesis that we haven't voted for a candidate since the, you know, the Kennedy-Nixon race. I think after that, when we got Goldwater and, you know, 64 and LBJ, to me, it was, you know, the other guy's going to kill us. And that's you know, that's ridden us to where we are now. But, there was a Pew survey. I don't know whether you saw this. Pew surveyed 10,000 people. They released it a couple of weeks ago, and they found that 65% of the people who said they were voting for Mr. Biden said not for his policies. They were voting against Trump. 65%.
That's just what's happening here. That's exactly right. And those that are voting for Trump are voting for Trump because they like Trump. And it's not necessarily the animus against Biden, although I know that most Trump voters don't have a lot of use for Biden, but it is this election could turn on, and if the polls are accurate, it will turn on what we call a negative vote. And that's it. It's not necessarily, I mean, if you really talk the Biden voters out there, they would have a very difficult time explaining precisely what Joe Biden plans to do if he wins the presidency. But it is without a doubt, Paul, you're correct. It's a vote against the incumbent president as opposed to a vote for the challenger.
Dr. Gary Rose is the guest, professor, chairman of the Government and Politics Department at Sacred Heart University. Gary, the Biden campaign dealing with a couple of things I find interesting. They have not denied that any of these emails or texts regarding Hunter Biden, they're not coming out and saying they're not real, which is kind of interesting, but a lot of people in my business, Gary, in the journalism business, even the people covering the campaign as best they can, there seems to be a reluctancy to kind of force this issue because I don't think they're going to get a lot out of the Biden campaign on this.
No, they're not. And I think the silence, though, quite frankly, for those of us who follow politics is deafening. But at the same time, I think for the general voters, This Hunter Biden business with Ukraine and even in China and 10% for the big guy, I'm not sure that the voters are really tuned in on this. And I think the Biden campaign knows the less they respond to it, the less relevant it is in their voting decision. And so I don't think we're going to hear an awful lot about that. I don't know if it's going to come up in the debate tonight. I suspect that Trump's going to try to, you know, build it into a response, but nevertheless, for most voters, this I don't think is a paramount issue. It's other issues are front and center. You know, like the president's handling of COVID. Obviously, that's really real high up there on the list. Not Joe Biden's son and his, you know, dealings with Burisma and China, even though, quite frankly, I think those are relevant issues. But for most voters, I think they're looking beyond that.
Hey, you know what, Gary, what they may say, and I don't know whether it would wash with people if this gets hairy over the next week and a half. I guess they can say, well, you know, Mr. Joe was out of office. You know, he wasn't doing this when was a sitting vice president. Maybe he would have told his son, no, I don't want to be involved in this. So, you know, that could be a fallback. The other issue here that, of course, is driving the discussion here is this whole Supreme Court packing thing, which, you know, Gary, I think in his heart of hearts, Biden knows this is not good. I mean, he's even come out and spoken out against this before, but he's trying to walk that fine. Like, he doesn't want to upset the far left. And, you know, he's, what did he say the last couple of days? I want to set up a commission to look at this stuff. I mean, he's really kind of boxed in on this. Yeah.
Yeah, whenever you set up a commission, that's a non-answer. And there's nothing's going to happen after that. But he knows that, you know, going back to Roosevelt in 1937, that this is a very, very dangerous path to go down when you start talking about adding judges, but justices. But you're right, though. He does. He has to at all times, and I think we're seeing that in the campaign, and we're going to see that again should he win the presidency. Is that I think he's going to be very tentative in his responses and in his leadership decisions, largely because that progressive wing of the Democratic Party is just absolutely hovering over him. And I think we're seeing that already in just his conduct as a campaigner.
And, you know, Gary, I can see, I said this on my show the other day, I can see him winning and getting inaugurated and starting to get this pressure, right? And I can see, you know, the old line Democrat in him maybe bringing in some people to the Oval Office, shutting the door and saying, listen, you people, listen, I ran on being a centrist. I didn't run on these cockamamie ideas of defunding the police and adding justices and all this. So sit down and shut up. I can actually see him doing that.
Well, yeah, maybe so. I mean, he's an old politician, that's true, and he did make a name for himself as largely a centrist Democrat. But I would still suggest, though, that the Bernie Sanders wing and the progressive wing and, you know, AOC and all of that, the pressure is on. And I think we're going to see just how much pressure they are going to be imposing on him when it comes time to start picking cabinet officers. And, you know, they're not going to go away by any means. And, yes, he's an old pal, as you say, and an old, you know, Democrat. But nevertheless, that's not where, you know, so much of that party has changed. So much of it has changed. I think we're going to really see that should he win. We're seeing it now in the campaign. It's going to continue.
Yeah. Final question. How are your students reacting to all this? Are their heads spinning? Are you trying to keep them from? Are you talking any of them off the ledge, Gary? Are they okay?
Well, yeah. I mean, we talk all the time about this, and our students. But you know, the Hunter Biden thing, it doesn't seem to be an issue in the minds of students. And again, it gets back to what I was suggesting before, that they're more concerned about which of these two individuals is going to deal with this COVID issue, because here they are, students, you know, wearing masks and doing all these things that we have to do, and they have to go on Zoom at times, you know, in order to meet with professors. They can't meet with them. And so, you know, the Hunter Biden, Ukraine, 10% for the big guy, that's far down the list in terms of their concerns. Their concerns is to get back to normal. And you know, I was teaching the presidency. I teach a presidency course, and we were talking about the 1920 election, you know, when Harding won, and that supposedly was a return to normalcy. And, you know, I'm just wondering if that's really what this election might be about.
Maybe. Gary Rose, Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chair, Department of Government and Politics, Sacred Heart University. Gary, as always, be good, and we'll talk to you down the road. Thank you so much.
Okay. Good, Paul. Okay.
Thanks. Right, thanks, Gary. Bye-bye.
How that is impacting our economy, because the two are very closely related. A quick snapshot since yesterday. You should see that we continue to do a lot of PCR testing, 22,000. The positivity rate of 2.3%. I can say that's a lot better than where we were a couple of days ago. I can tell you it's not a lot more than where we were a couple of months ago. Take that for what it is. It's trending up in a slightly controlled way, I'd like to think. Fatalities, 2. Hospitalizations, 19. Hospitalizations are up. As you remember, infections are a leading indicator, and hospitalizations lag a little bit. They are up 232, some of our highest we've had in a couple of months. Remember, at our worst, we were 2,000 COVID-related hospitalizations. A couple of things have changed on hospitalizations in the last 6 months, which you should probably know about. Back then, about a third of our people that went to the hospital ended up in the ICU, intensive care. Today, it's not one third, but it's 20%. I think that shows that we have some better therapies and we're screening people earlier, which is a real positive. Back then, probably 22% of the folks who ended up in the ICU, they were fatal. Today, it's 6%. So you see, they're making incredible progress when it comes to keeping people alive and keeping people out of the ICU. The average age of fatality is still about, or median age is still about 80. So the demographics have not changed quite as dramatically when it comes to hospitalizations as maybe we could have anticipated before. This next chart is the one we said we're going to release every Thursday, and it gives you an idea of what the spread is like in our state. And obviously, if you're in the gray, you have as few cases as we've had in a long time. Most of Litchfield County is looking pretty good. A lot of Fairfield County was pretty good. Norwalk and Fairfield are flared up. You can see if you got really good glasses, they're red. This is a little bit like a mirror image from where we were in May when Fairfield County was on fire and Southeast Connecticut was not hit very hard. Today you see most of the red is in that area of Southeastern Connecticut. I can tell you those areas that are in the red alert, 15-plus cases per 100,000 on a daily basis. We've gone from 11 to 19 towns. So you can see it is continuing to extend yet again. But there is some progress. New London and Norwich and Danbury are continuing the trend down. So when we bring in the rapid response and over a period of time, I think we are able to get this contained. Danbury, again, that's not going to be red next week if we're doing our job and if everybody is maintaining the discipline there. And that is not spreading to its neighboring town. So I take that as a very good news. By the same token, Norwalk and Fairfield down there in lower Fairfield County, they are more like a hockey stick. So those are the two sides of the equation. I can just tell you on this next chart, this is what our recommendations are. First of all, in the darker blue, East Hartford, Fairfield, Groton, Lisbon, Norwalk, Plainfield, Prospect, Salem, Waterbury, and Waterford are all the add-ons to our red alert list. Thankfully, East Lyme and Preston have gone off, so it's not static, but it is a reminder that it is expanding. What does the red alert mean? Let me just remind you. A, we noticed you, and Deirdre and Max were on with all the public health and mayors from those red alert towns, you know, re-emphasizing, if you're 65, stay home. Here we go again. No unnecessary travel. We're going to work on our be able to do the home delivery, the DoorDash, everything we can. Limit your meetings with non-family members, those that you're not very close to. I know we've got the holiday season coming up, but especially in these red alert areas where there's real community spread, special time to be very careful. Again, we have to pay extra attention to our nursing homes, and that's why we are ramping up our testing of staff at all of our nursing homes around the state, and making a special priority for residents and visitors in our red alert areas. I'm a little surprised, by the way, that CMS, coming out of the federal government, continues to mandate visitations at nursing homes, saying you can't require testing for visitors to nursing homes. But I think Deirdre would back me up in saying it is a strong recommendation, especially in those red alert areas. If you care about the loved ones in the nursing homes, be strict about testing people before they go in and visit. As you know, towns can revert to phase two. That sends a signal, I think, to some folks that this is serious and you're in a red alert town. Of that list here, I think only Wyndham has actually taken advantage of that, but it is an option. And I can't say this enough. The three W's, wear the mask, wash your hands, watch your distance. Let me change gears for a second, and Melissa's going to help us out with this, but there's been some press about it, and I thought it was worth describing. You know, we're learning all the time when it comes to COVID, and the only thing that changes as fast as COVID is the economics and the economic projections and what's going on in our region as regards the economy. And right now, it's relative good news. Thankfully, Melissa McCaw is very conservative in her projections. And we had thought, you know, going back a few months, we didn't know when this economy would start recovering. We didn't know when the stock market was going to be recovering. And we budgeted conservatively, and I really appreciate that. Today, where we have a little more history we can point to, it looks like our deficit won't be what we thought it could have been, a couple billion dollars, and it's down to, you know, about a 40% reduction on that, 1.2 or so. And that makes a big difference in terms of what we're thinking about for this fiscal year, which ends June 30. That's, I think, is good news. Why are we doing better than a lot of our peers, and why are we doing better than what we had just projected, you know, a few months ago? What's going on there? Well, our revenue has improved by $454 million compared to what we had projected a few months ago. And that's because we're still down from where we were a year ago, but we're up from what we had projected. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One, we have more people paying taxes. We've had tens of thousands of people move into the state of Connecticut. We're one of the magnet states. We're net loser going back a number of years where more people were leaving the state. Now they're coming in. They are paying sales tax. Some of them are beginning to pay a capital gains tax. A lot of that $295 million is paid for more by wealthy people because who would have thought back in April or May that the stock market would have doubled in the last 6 months, up 14% for the whole year. Those folks are going to be contributing a little more to our state. $160 million in sales and use tax, cigarette tax. Sales and use tax, again, we have more people paying it because our economy is coming back. And I think it was thoughtful of the state to extend or reform our sales tax so it also includes internet sales, not just bricks and mortar sales. And that really helped save us a fair amount of what could have been lost revenue in the sales tax side. Well, on the flip side, we've reduced our costs by over $300 million compared to what we had anticipated earlier on in our budget projections. A lot of that, over half of that, is related to health care, is related to Medicaid. Some of that is due to some improved federal reimbursement we're getting that is tied to COVID. I don't know if that goes forever. It won't go forever. And some of that is because of some reforms that we're making, lower levels of service utilization. Some of that is people just nervous about going back into the emergency room or seeing their so a lot of these services that have been put off should take place. We'll see whether there are any permanent reforms that bring down our health care costs, but that's generally good news. And finally, the mitigation plan, you see $125 billion in savings compared to what was budgeted before. I think a lot of that is Josh Jabal, Chief of Staff, you know, working across all of our different departments, trying to find efficiencies that could be long lasting, not just short term. We will see. I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but right now, compared to our peers in other states, our budget is in relatively a better position, and this can change pretty fast. The Connecticut employment picture is worth taking a look at as well. Just to show you that, you know, during the depths of COVID back last April, you know, we were down 83% of employment. That was an enormous unemployment hit to us. And you've seen that now we're back at over 93%, if you can watch that chart going out to September 20th. And that has a lot of meaning. A, that's the best in the Northeast. Our people have gone back to work more. Our downdraft down at 83% in April was a little less than our peers because we kept manufacturing open and outside construction, some things that you know about. But you'll see, and we can tell from Europe, that we'll see where that trend goes going forward. But it's good news for us if we can keep it going, keeping our economy going, and we can only keep our economy going if we keep COVID in check. This next chart, and then I won't bore you with any more of these detailed charts, is just gives you a little comparison to this recession compared to 1990 and 2001 and 2008. And the red line is our short history of the COVID recession. It is not your grandparents' traditional recession, where you can see goes down more gradually and up over a period of many months and years. In fact, you can see that 2008 recession, which is the green line, we only got back to 99% of full employment. You can see, again, red, that first, 8 months that we've gone, a sharp downdraft. It's, some people call it a V-shaped a recovery, but it's a lot sharper than that, the San Andreas fault. But 93.3% is by no means something you can count on that trend going forward. I was on the phone with Europe today regarding some businesses, and they're moving into curfew. Infections are up by a factor of 10 compared to where they were before, and they're worried about further turning back their economy, which they're desperate not to do. So take nothing for granted, but this gives you an idea at least how we're doing economically, how we're doing compared to other recessions, and what our COVID response looks like on a statewide basis. So with that, Josh and Paul, Deirdre, Melissa, and I are happy to take your questions.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, I'd like to go back to hospitalizations if we could. What does the hospital capacity look like right now, and at what point do we need to be concerned about them filling back up?
Well, I'll start with that, and then somebody smarter can help me out. But right now, as you remember, in the bad old days, we had 2,000 COVID-related folks in our hospital rooms, and they were staying in there a longer period of time. Today, we're a little over 200, so we have a lot more capacity than we did before, and people are spending a little less time in the hospital, a little less likely to go to the ICU, which is, the most limited. We have some extra, people in the hospitals today related to elective surgeries, a lot of which were being put off in the early days. And there's something the hospitals have the ability to throttle a little bit based upon need going forward. But looking at hospital capacity is going to be very important to me over the next few months. Josh, Deirdre, anything to add to that?
Yeah, and just in terms of the statistics, statewide, a quarter of hospital beds in total are unutilized right now. And that's, as the governor said, without any actions being taken by the hospitals to free up beds from elective procedures or anything. And only about half of the ICU beds are occupied. So, although the trends on hospitalizations have been increasing, and we are watching that very carefully, as a percentage of our total hospital capacity, the number of COVID hospitalizations we have is still very low.
One other thing I would add is you might recall that that the governor developed these COVID recovery facilities during the first wave of the pandemic. And one of the key functions of that was to allow people to be discharged from the hospital who needed to go to have some additional care, but didn't need a hospital level of care. We have kept those facilities available. And if needed, we can call on that capacity as well to help people get discharged from the hospital sooner if they need to be.
And Governor, going back to the red alert towns, the concentration for the third week in a row seems to be southeastern Connecticut. What, if anything, should the casinos be doing to help combat the spread? And are you satisfied with their approach right now so far?
I think I am. I don't think you see anything going from the casinos to Norwich. I worry more about community spread, perhaps infecting the casinos. My understanding, and Deirdre can help me out with this, is casinos have ramped up their testing significantly for employees and their families because everybody wants to avoid a flare-up there as possible.
NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor Matt Austin. Matt with NBC Connecticut. I was wondering, as you were saying before, it appears that only Wyndham has chosen to roll back to phase two at this point. If communities keep choosing not to fall back, would the alert system be rethought or refigured? Would it potentially require communities to do that?
Not yet, and not at 15 per 100,000, but if we had a higher intensity of infections, if we saw more community spread, if we thought it was impacting the region more, we'd have to take a second look at that. I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, and also, just depending on how many cities and towns are added to that list, would there be a tipping point where the entire state would have to return to phase two?
Again, I think it would have to be a lot more intense than what you see. But I was talking about Europe, they're doing more and more on a regional basis over there. And if you think that Europe maybe is a month ahead of us, I hope that's not the case. We're going to have to think as well. I mean, I spent a lot of time talking to Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, and New Jersey. We had taken a break from each other for a couple of months. But now we're talking again and hoping to God that while we keep transportation open between our respective areas, and I think we'll be able to announce something with Rhode Island and Massachusetts at some point soon, we're also thinking about what we have to do in terms of a response to COVID, if we have to do a unified response.
Okay, thank you.
News 8.
Hey, Governor, this is Eva with News 8. I hope you're doing well. I had a quick question in regards to nursing homes. I know that a lot of people are looking to nursing homes now. We're seeing that some nursing homes are actually taking it upon themselves now to actually do visitor testing. Do you see the state stepping in at all to make this a requirement as we're watching these numbers tick up, especially with these vulnerable populations?
Deirdre tells me the federal government won't let us do that. Deirdre?
Yes. So we would like to very strongly urge anyone visiting a nursing home to get tested. Some of the facilities are using antigen tests that were supplied by Health and Human Services, Federal Health and Human Services, to offer testing, rapid testing on site. We're distributing some of those Binax cards you heard the governor talk about last week or the week before. We're distributing some of those to nursing facilities. But if the facility where your loved one resides does not have that antigen testing available on site, we would strongly urge you to get tested before you visit your loved one. And of course, the mask and hygiene and distancing is really critical. Nursing facilities are very susceptible and vulnerable, as we've learned the hard way during this pandemic, to the infection being brought in. And it's very difficult to control once it's in the facility. So out of respect for our elderly residents and disabled residents in our nursing facilities, everyone who's visiting really should get tested and be super, super vigilant on the mask wearing and distancing.